Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Erin, thank you very much for the introduction and thank you very much for the organisers to invite me here today. Sitting in the last session, I was aware that Aaron kept referring to the difficult titles that he may have given the presenters to work to, and I have to say that I felt similarly this was a difficult title to work to, but being Antipodean and rule-focused, I followed the task. So, David Willetts, of course, is coming in later, so it's fair to say that Alex and I are clearly just warm-up acts, and you can't wait till we leave the stage so that David then says something useful. Today we're publishing, the Higher Education Academy is publishing, the second piece of work that we had commissioned Graham Gipps to do on dimensions of quality. And I'm taking here, without his approval, an excerpt from his foreword. He and I both wrote forewords for this document. And I've just taken out a little bit here that David has written. And I'm also reliably informed David actually wrote the foreword himself. And so that's why I've chosen to use these words. Now, whether we agree with these or not doesn't matter. I just want to start my presentation today about teaching and where it sits within the student experience in the context of what the Minister for Universities and Science in England is actually saying, some of the important features that he believes are relevant for higher education. And the way I want to approach my presentation is by giving you a series of questions. And there are no answers to these questions, in my opinion, which are correct. And so what I present to you today is merely a set of commentaries from my experience working in higher education, and particularly in the UK over a 25-plus year period, and also interspersing that with some of the impact that the Higher Education Academy's work has had in trying to understand some of these things, try and support some of these things, so that, as again Liam said in the start there, we support learning and teaching in the UK higher education system, and as a consequence of that, we make a difference of a demonstrable effect and a positive direction to the student learning experience. And so that's how I want to approach this. So Doris was on TV when I was young, playing a teacher here. What's involved in teaching? It's a rhetoric question, and I'm not going to go through these in detail. I merely want you to start stimulating your own thinking, and hopefully that will then result in some questions for you to me later about what you might think teaching is. Because it's a very interesting concept that as we move into the second decade, or well into the second decade of the 21st century, if we were to look back at the history of higher education in the UK back to the 1200s when the first university was established, are we seeing much of a difference in the way in which the pedagogic model for delivery to higher education has changed? And if I look here at what I'm doing today, and I'm always critical of myself, I'm doing something to you today which was done back in the 1200s, which is to stand up here in the belief that I know something more than you, and you're listening to my content in the belief that I'm imparting knowledge to you. I'm sorry, it's an outdated model. So, yeah, what is it about? And I'm really just giving you some rhetoric comments to think about there. And I don't think any of us would disagree that what's up there has some relevance to a teaching process. Whether or not what we do in teaching is correct, right, proper, contemporary, for me are very challenging questions in a sector which has 2.5 million students inside the UK boundary being delivered to in higher education programs. Even a more challenging question, what is good teaching? And this, for me, is a really, really difficult one to ever get close to at all, and I don't think I've got it right here. But I'm aware, and I actually have real examples of this, one colleague who is now Vice-Chancellor, who, when they were an academic member of staff delivering content to student, would stand up and read content to the students in front of them. All right, that's a fact. Current serving VC, not in this room at the moment. Now, you might say, well, that can't be very good teaching. And it's not for me to evaluate whether it is or not. But what I know happened beyond that teaching content, that delivery of written script, was that the students then went into tutorial sessions where the discussions were incredibly rich and vibrant and where the learning was embodied in the student experience. So how can we possibly say what is good teaching, what is bad teaching? That's my point here. And again, I put down the side here some of the things, academic knowledge. Clearly we want staff who are teaching to be academically credible. There's a list of words there. But I've taken a quote there from a round table which the Higher Education Academy facilitated just a few weeks ago, and this was published in The Guardian on Tuesday this week. When asked to define a good teacher, they said, students, it was a person who turned up early and told them exactly what they had to do to get a good mark. That's a direct student quote. Now, I don't feel comfortable with that, and I'll come back to that concept a little bit later on another slide. you knew I was going to get onto this, and if you didn't, then you were naive. This is an advert taken out of the paper early this week. I was sitting on the train back to York. The Evening Standard's always a favourite for me in the afternoon. And I sat down and I saw this advert in the paper. So this is taken a bit blurry with my iPhone, and then I transferred it across here. And you've seen these adverts before, but you've probably ignored them. But what this advert's telling you is that if you want to become a graduate trainee teacher, the government's prepared to pay you £20,000 to train up to become a teacher. Now, why am I telling you that? Because in the state-funded system in the UK, it is compulsory for teachers in primary and secondary school to hold a qualification to teach. And the government at the moment is spending £20,000 a year to do that. We go to a university, and there is no obligation to have a teaching qualification. There is no package put in place to fund that. And there is no requirement in most universities to actually complete any qualification for teaching that you might be required to register for in the first place. So some universities have mandatory registration for new staff in higher education. They don't always, in fact, they don't very often have a mandatory requirement to complete it successfully. Curious, isn't it? There's 180,000 academics teaching in the UK higher education system. If I'm to suggest that my organisation, and I'm not saying we're a monopoly, and that's what's been criticised by Hefty of us, we are not a monopoly, but we do look after the UK professional standards framework for you. There's 143 accredited programs for teaching qualifications, postgraduate certificates or something similar in the UK. We know from our data, which may not be accurate, that there are currently 38,000 of those 180,000 academics who hold fellowship either through recognition, by giving us a portfolio of experiences, or by completing a postgraduate certificate. Now, I'm prepared, even though I've got a maths degree, I'm prepared to accept I can't count. So I'd like to double that number and say let's round it off at 60,000. 60,000 staff in the UK are qualified to teach. We've still got 120,000 who aren't. And I just leave that thought with you. What is the student experience? And these were questions I had on my third slide, and they're all back to the title that I was given to talk to. So what is the student experience? I don't know what the student experience is. I think in the last session we had some very good descriptions of it. I thought Liam gave a very good summary of parts of the student experience. In my organisation, we are very much embroiled in the student learning experience. So it's the academic part of that experience that we're talking about. But of course, the student experience, and Liam said this, is also about student unions. It's about clubs and societies. It's about all the extra things that people do. And great that we're seeing now through the Higher Education Achievement Report those things potentially being more visibly recognised so that employers can say it wasn't just about the content of your degree, but it was also all the other things that you did, the skills that you learned, the places that you went, so the international study, the work placement that you had, the exchange program, the Erasmus, 13,000 out of 2.5 million. Big numbers, eh? Not really. And I've given you an excerpt of the student experience survey run by the Times Higher. Now, I'm not saying that's a credible survey. I'm not criticising it either. The numbers, if you can read them there, say 14,000 students responded to that. So these judgments about that particular survey are based on small numbers. But I think, again, it gets to the point of something which Liam said earlier about perhaps engagement is what we need to be looking at here rather than experiences. And I do see that changing. You know, changing the learning landscapes is a program we're looking at and working with institutions on. We're also doing some work around students with students as partners with institutions like Birmingham City. There's lots of change programs happening that are looking at learning experiences for students in a different way. NSS, just had to put it up. The data's going up. So 11 to 12, question 22, we're seeing a shift there from 83% of students satisfied to 85% of students satisfied. And when this survey first came out, Bill Rammell, who's now VC at Bedfordshire, was the Minister for Higher Education in England, and he said, look, if over 80% of students in the UK, or in England rather, are satisfied with their learning experience, that's pretty damn good. Well, sure it is. It's up at 85% now. So we're actually doing a lot of good stuff. I'm not up here criticising. I'm merely saying the landscape's changing, the expectations are different, and in the same way that those of you who go out of here in a moment and drive your car away are expected to have a licence, perhaps we should also be expecting academic staff and universities to have some form of certification, and I'll come back to that with my final slide. The Higher Education Academy does oversee the UK Professional Standards Framework for you. We produced it in 2006. We reviewed it the year before last and relaunched a revised version in November 2011. It has 4 points of contact for accreditation and recognition, descriptors 1 through 4, which I've described here as fellowships, as associate fellow through to principal fellow. So these things are in place. What we're encouraging institutions to do now are develop their own CPD frameworks because, again, if I use a metaphor to explain this, when I came to the UK back in the 80s, I got a driving licence in the UK, and it's legal until I'm 65. And I'm way younger than that, by the way. I don't have to go back for a retest. I don't have to check whether or not I'm up to date with the latest laws of the road, which change regularly. And I find that surprising. Of course, now there is a 10-year licensing program and you've got to get it renewed, but it's a paper renewal process rather than a retesting. But what I want are CPD frameworks. In the same way that your GP, to maintain their registration with the medical council, have got to complete programs every year which show they're aware of new medicines coming out so they can prescribe correctly to you and other changes in their program. And if they don't do that, they will be struck off the registration list. Now, surely that seems sensible in a profession, which we are. So lots of things going on here that we're working on. A good standing and a code of conduct is some work that we're doing in the Higher Education Academy because we believe that the fellows, the 38,000 I mentioned before, should have to demonstrate some sort of ongoing commitment to developing their practice as good teachers. We want that to be in place. We want to work with you to achieve that. We're using an external company at the moment to frame it for us, and then we'll be coming out on consultation. And then there's some other examples there of how things can be identified as good teachers. And then I thought I'd throw in a curveball here and say, well, think about now, if teaching, my side title, if teaching were at the centre of the student experience, what would it look like? Now, here are some contentious ideas. Promotions would be based on teaching performance. I'm going to read them. Vice chancellors would be fellows of the Higher Education Academy. I can say there are 21 vice chancellors in the UK who are fellows of the Higher Education Academy. All right? So I am pleased about that, but it's only 21, and the number is bigger than that by some distance. National teaching fellowships might be the high point, and the Prime Minister might say, I want to identify the best teacher in the country every year and call them the Prime Minister's Outstanding Teacher of the Year. You might not agree with these things. I'm not trying to get you to agree. Developing students' full potential would be a dual and shared role. Now, you might already say that's the case at the moment. I'm not really sure it is consistently the case, and I think that's why I'm posing that question. The most valued research grants would be those in pedagogy and learning and teaching. That's what academics would be pursuing for. Give me the big money because it's in pedagogy and learning and teaching. Wow, how would that be? But even just turn that around for a minute. Why can't the research councils at the moment require that when research bids go in, as they do in America, that you must demonstrate how this will impact on learning and teaching when you win a research grant? Very simple question to put in, but it's not there. Not there. And employers would be more involved in the intimate relationship of developing learning and teaching, it says on the next line. We funded some work at Hertfordshire University, and I just want to take a little time to talk about this. I know I'm running out of time, but I've only got a few slides left. If you ask earlier what the student wants, what a good student is, what a learning experience is, what a good teacher is, you can start to create a rhetoric. If I say to you, what's a good student? The good student might be the one that turns up on time, listens to everything that you're saying, takes notes during the course of the lecture, produces the assessments on time, does exactly what you want, creates the learning outcomes, and out the door they go. But is that really what we want? Or do we want the good learner, which is the student that comes in and says, I don't agree with what you're saying. I'm sorry, I've got a different opinion than that. Why are we being assessed in this particular way? And I'm sure many of you have seen the cartoon assessment task where the teacher's sitting in front of a group of students and the teacher says, to be fair to everybody, you're all going to do the same assessment. Go and climb the tree. And, of course, the students are a giraffe, an elephant, a monkey, a fish. It's pretty sensible stuff, isn't it? But we don't think about it sensibly. So I think we want the good learner, the person who is challenging to us, who is going to be helped in their lifelong learning ability to love education and love the subject that you're talking about, so that when they leave the room, it's not about when's the assessment, when it's due, and what have I got to do. It's about how do we know more about this subject? And I'm sorry, I am anally retentive. When I came to the UK as a mature student to do a master's degree, I went to Birmingham University. I was over 30. And I was not, and I can tell you this honestly, I was not interested in how to pass that master's degree. I was interested in the content and knowledge of that degree. And I walked in 1986, I walked in one December morning, about 4 miles to the university, when it was snowing and all the public transport was closed, because I thought everybody else would have done the same thing, to find that when I got there, I was one of the sole entrants in the university. But I had a great day in the library. But it was about the passion for learning, and I still have it. I have a passion for learning. And I appreciate we can't get 2.5 million learners wanting a passion for learning, but by God, we've got to try and do something about creating that. Oops. I was told about that button. And just to throw in a contentious word, customers, I'll leave you with it. What do governments want? I've no idea. They want employable students. They want a return on their investment. And even in England now, where the student loan company, which is really exchequer money, so the government's still paying for the higher education system, the government wants its return on investment, and that's only fair. So we have to be sensitive to that, and we have to be responsive to that. And that creates perhaps a changed dynamic about why students are at university and what they're trying to achieve. What do students want? Again, I can't answer this question, and I'm too far away from being that student that some of you in this room still are. But what do you want? I don't know. Good teaching, inspiration, support, encouragement, feedback, positive outcomes, modern methods. By that I mean using the appropriate technology. I don't mean using electronic technology. I'm very happy that most mathematics staff throughout the UK higher education system believe that the blackboard and chalk is still the contemporary method for delivering mathematics. I'm a maths graduate. I don't agree with that, but I'm not delivering. What don't they want? They probably don't want the burgeoning debt, which this is an old graphic, the burgeoning debt that has been estimated now at somewhere between £50,000 and £60,000 that students joining university this year in England, or if they're English domiciled and they've gone to any of the other nations, will be creating. And, of course, if they're going to Edinburgh or St Andrews, it will be £9,000 plus more than that. Just thought I'd throw that in. I'm nearly finished. So, should teachers in higher education require a qualification to teach? It's a rhetoric question. I'm just leaving it with you because we're at a fork in the road. That's my graphic here. We are at a fork in the road. And look at this one. Let's be really edgy here. Should teachers in higher education require an annual license to practice that has to be renewed by some form of CPD? Yeah, I just want to challenge you. I'm not sitting up here saying the Higher Education Academy requires this. I've been criticised for saying that before. On video, I did not say the Higher Education Academy requires a licence to teach. And I'm finishing with an extract from a publication back in 1998, but I think it's still relevant, and I've tried to guide you through it with some bolding out and reading of what good teaching is. Lebonc's article was, what are the 10 points of a good teacher? I think they're still relevant ones, but I thought here this was probably something related to where we might want to think about in terms of good teaching. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.